we're not about promoting technology for tech's sake. In fact, I think that's perhaps where organizations have made mistakes in the past, where technologists have made mistakes in the past, where we promote a tool over the people that use the tool. Essentially, TAG is about tech for social good. It's asking the question, how can technology be used strategically for organizations to realize the mission?
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control Clickcast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're going to talk about philanthropy tech with Chantal Forster. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is sponsored by Arcus Tech, who hosts this very show. Have Arcus Tech's helpful support team manage servers for you so you can focus on designing and developing client sites instead of getting stuck with sysadmin work. As an official Kraft CMS hosting partner, they have various plans optimized for Kraft, and you can pick between two US locations and the EU too. Sound good? Take 15% off the first 3 months of your single or multi-server monthly plan with the discount code CONTROLCLICK120. We'll spell it out in the show notes. It's valid until the next episode airs, so sign up today.
One of our goals for this podcast is to inspire our listeners to use their skills in the web and tech to make positive change in their communities. We've talked about how design thinking can help address problems like workplace inequality and the pay gap, and even how data can help a city's tech community become more vibrant and diverse. Today, we're going to talk about philanthropy tech, how technology can and is being used for the public good, especially in the nonprofit industry. To guide us in this discussion is Chantal Forster. Chantal is an IT consultant who has led community-driven technology initiatives for public and social sector clients for a decade. Currently, she is executive director of the Technology Affinity Group, which promotes the strategic use of technology in philanthropy. Welcome to the show, Chantal.
Hello. Hello from Chicago. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Sure, I am happy to. You know, I have spent my entire career in IT, but it's interesting, my entire educational background has been in the humanities. So I've worked in the private sector, the public sector, and now the social sector as the executive director for the Technology Affinity Group, which is an association for IT leaders in foundations in the United States, North America, and beyond.
And Chantal, you mentioned you've been working in technology your entire career, but how did you even get started in that, especially with an education based in the humanities?
You know, it's funny. My father actually is a computer scientist and my mother is an art historian. So I like to think I'm caught right in the middle. My father actually taught me how to program in BASIC when I was about 8 years old. So there was just an early comfort with technology. I mean, that actually informs STEM education, right? That kind of early comfort and fluency can really inform your career choices.
Absolutely. I think that's a common thread amongst our guests and even ourselves. So for today's topic, let's start with the basics. And this is actually a completely brand new area for me. I feel excited to learn about this. What is philanthropy tech?
You know, it is a great question. The nonprofit sector in the United States is so big and so varied that when you say something like philanthropy tech, most people don't know what that is. So I'll just distill it. What we mean by philanthropy tech is the technology in use to support the mission of a philanthropy. And by a philanthropy, we mean foundations, whether that's a private foundation, a family foundation, a community foundation. We can get into that a little bit more later, but the essence of it is philanthropy tech is tech to support the mission of foundations.
So can you share like a real life example of philanthropy tech at work? Maybe something our listeners might see and take for granted or not even recognize what it is?
Sure. I think it's important to, I'll move into an example, but it's also important to think about what's the scope of philanthropy in this country. There are 85,000 foundations in the United States. The total giving, foundation giving in the United States is about $60 billion annually. That, I mean, we need to sit with that for a minute, right? That is equal to the federal spending for NASA plus the EPA plus the Department of Transportation plus the Department of Agriculture. That's how much money foundations give in the United States each year. Right? I'm sitting with that too. It's a heavy financial burden. It's a very large financial opportunity for social change makers and difference makers in our communities.
So how does tech come into play with this?
Well, let's do a real world scenario like you asked about. Let's say you are a nonprofit and you're working on preventing domestic violence in a particular community. And let's say you want to work on a new initiative to maybe train survivors to become advocates for intervention in their communities. So to develop this new initiative, where are you going to get the money? So what typically occurs is such a nonprofit would go to funders and apply for funding. So I'll just walk you through that process, and you can imagine how technology is embedded every step in the way. First, that nonprofit would apply online. There'd be a grant application. They'd apply for the grant. They would share materials, attach them to the application. Then there's some back and forth with the funder during that application process. And all of that uses, guess what, email or a collaboration site. And then you submit all of your paperwork. There's a lot of financial due diligence. At some point, you get paid. You sign contracts online. Then you go out and do the work in your community. And as part of that work, you're also communicating with your funder. Sometimes you have a question and they have an idea for you. You also report to that funder and evaluate at the end of the grant, how well did it work? When you trained these survivors to become advocates for intervention, did you see an increase in people seeking help? So the last step would be, and this is something we sometimes forget, is if that is a successful intervention, how do you share that success story? Mm-hmm. So that's the whole digital communication realm. It's creating a succinct and convincing report to describe your approach and what was unique about it. So every step of the way in that process, there's technology. And then think about how this process is scaled all over the country for the, I think it's about 1.5 million nonprofits in the United States. That's a lot of philanthropy tech.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to know if you can share a contrasting perspective. So before technology had such an integral role to this process, what was the analog? What were they doing? Was it just papers and faxing and maybe having to travel more on site?
All of the above. The on-site travel piece is still very important because a lot of the work in communities is very relational. And so a funder doesn't want to just write a check blindly. They actually want to understand the conditions in a particular community and understand what may be needed there in an authentic way. So that in-person work still exists, but it's done in a much more meaningful fashion. So instead of the transactional work, it's relational work now in person. And all of that transactional work can be done online. And so in pragmatic terms, what I've seen and many of my organization's members is that their time from application to funding the work for a nonprofit, that's very important. Nonprofits need their money to deliver programs. So that time between application, approval, receiving the funding has shrunk from months and months to, in some funders' cases, less than a month.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So that's putting money where the nonprofit's hands so they can get out in community and do the great work.
So before we talk a little bit more about the tech, I'm curious if there are misconceptions about tech and philanthropy. And I actually wanted to put something out there. As we were preparing for this episode, as I mentioned, this is a new area for me. I'm not familiar with it. And so whenever I thought about tech and philanthropy, I was actually thinking about some of the more seems to be lately headline making news about leaders, billionaires in tech and Silicon Valley putting money towards a charity. And so that's what I thought this was about. But what I'm hearing from you, that is that it's more the actual mechanism where tech is driving philanthropy.
You know, that is a perfect segue. And in fact, I would say that highlights one of the most common misconceptions about tech and philanthropy. So in the past, IT and philanthropy was all about the operational side of the house, keeping the internet up, keeping the laptops on, making sure that grant applications are now online. But what we're starting to see is a belief that technology can actually serve, scale, and even drive an organization's mission. So going beyond just the operations, yes, all of that's still true, and we still need to do all of that. My leaders still spend a great deal of their energy and their staffing and their budget to support the operations of their organization. But where we're seeing growth and where we're actually seeing a lot of growing awareness that this work is real is in the ability to drive and serve that organization and be a part of how a funder makes change in the community. So for example, imagine if you had $1 million to give away in Detroit. Detroit has about 700,000 people. There's about 36% poverty rate in Detroit. How far is $1 million really going to go? Mm-hmm. Not very far. So there's a great example of a foundation, the Ralph C. Wilson Jr. Foundation in Detroit. They're granting about $5 million to start a center for nonprofit support. And what they're doing there is using a business incubator group, Tech Town. It's a business incubator in Detroit. And they're funding Tech Town to transfer its entrepreneurship approach to the nonprofits in the Detroit area. And that includes a strong technology component. So it's not in this case about keeping the laptops on and the internet up. It's about building capacity in local nonprofits to innovate, to be entrepreneurial, to use technology so that $5 million in this case can go much further to solving some of the social challenges in Detroit.
That actually reminds me of our conversation with Fabian Elliott about the importance of making the investment in the organizations and the people who are part of the community, because they are going to know best what the problems are and be a lot closer to the solutions and who's affected by those solutions.
I would say also with that episode, I think the emphasis that technology is the tool to help foster these particular, you know, problem-solving items as opposed to just the laptops in the office. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is a growing movement. You know, we can talk a little bit about that and what the Ford Foundation is doing with its public interest tech program. So the Ford Foundation has started to invest in what they're calling public interest tech. You can look that up, hashtag public interest tech. And it's a movement to drive people to use their technology skills for the public good. Mm-hmm. So typically those folks would be lured out to Silicon Valley. And what the Ford Foundation is trying to do, they're a member of ours, is create space for people with tech skills to also apply those skills in their communities, so that people who can speak both of those languages, the social good language and the technology language, that they have a home in this public interest tech movement and can connect with each other and innovate and drive new solutions to apply their skills for the greater good.
So, you know, it seems to me, at least from what you've been sharing, that this growth in terms of technology playing a greater role beyond operations, that could easily be described by just the evolution of tech being more responsive to, you know, what people need today. But I'm also curious, is there any part of philanthropy driving that tech to evolve, where the needs of the organizations who, you know, want to apply for funding or the foundations who want to give it are identifying spaces that tech can fill?
Emily, you know, it's a both and. So philanthropic giving is growing each year between about 2 to 3%, including adjustment for inflation. So in this country, philanthropic giving is growing. At the same time, what we're seeing is new types of givers. So philanthropists who maybe were born out of the tech industry. And so they get what technology can do to realize change at scale. And so I think you're seeing, to a certain extent, philanthropists understanding and the changing nature of philanthropy in this country. At the same time, that growth rate of giving changing, we're also unfortunately seeing that inequity in this country is growing. So that begs the question, even though giving is growing, inequity is also growing. So we're clearly not doing it well enough. How can we do more? How can we do better? So I think that very obvious question is also driving people to evaluate how technology can scale the investment. And the other thing we're seeing is, in line with this, funders also realizing that their job may not just be about writing a check anymore, but their job is to perhaps give their grantee partners, you know, the check receivers, their partners on the ground, the tools that they need to succeed. And that comes from listening to those grantee partners who say, thanks for the money. I love the idea that I want to realize outcomes, but I need help conducting evaluation. I need help with technology to do robust surveys with my beneficiaries. So they're asking for help from funders, like, what is a digital strategy? How can you help me and my organization develop a robust digital strategy? So in fact, what I just heard from a major funder in on the West Coast recently, to tech-focused philanthropy, and what they said was, you know, we as funders need to do a better job with our partners. In fact, we owe it to our grantees to make the same resources available to them for their work that we use in our work.
So they're like a board of advisors instead of just a board of funders.
That's a great way to put it. And I would say most philanthropies would tweak that language slightly and say a board of partners, of thought partners, rather than advisors. Most funders look at themselves as partners in the change with their grantees.
You know, as you describe that, is that a new thing in this area of philanthropy? Because I always had, this might be the misconception thing, but I had a perception that philanthropy was somewhat disconnected. The people funding were disconnected from the, like you explained, the grantees. Is that a correct idea from the past that's just since changed, or is that just a misconception?
You're right, Emily. That is changing. There are a couple of movements right now that I'd love to point out. So grassroots philanthropy, trust-based philanthropy, thinking about that relationship with the change maker, in this case, the nonprofit or the grantee, thinking about how that relationship can be conducted with greater authenticity. So for example, there's a family foundation in Chicago called the Pierce Family Foundation, endowed by Dennis Pierce, who's still alive and well, probably in Michigan today. The Pierce Family Foundation uses a methodology called grassroots philanthropy. And they work very closely with their grantees in Chicago, to the point where their IT director goes out to those nonprofits and, if they would like, will conduct a technology assessment of their end-to-end tools and systems so that they can be capacitated to better get the basics done and make more change on the ground. So that grassroots philanthropy approach, for example, is an arm-in-arm approach with grantees that is anything but distant.
Yeah, it seems that way. So with Technology Affinity Group, your mission is to promote technology and philanthropy. Can you describe what that looks like, what your organization does?
I'm happy to, and I'm glad you pointed that out. We're in the midst of updating our mission. As truth be told, we're not about promoting technology for tech's sake. In fact, I think that's perhaps where organizations have made mistakes in the past, or technologists have made mistakes in the past, where we promote a tool over the people that use the tool. Essentially, TAG is about tech for social good. It's asking the question, how can technology be used strategically for organizations to realize their mission? That's a different way of looking at the question. Mm-hmm. But this is in reality the way that my member organizations look at technology in their foundations.
So speaking of those organizations, what type of organizations are they?
So we currently have about 1,400 members in North America and beyond. Our member profile is really leaders and learners in IT and grants management within those foundations. And we have three types, maybe four types. We're growing in the corporate foundation area. So four types of member organizations. One are private foundations. That's what you typically think of. The Rockefeller Foundation, the Kellogg Foundation, for example. Number two, family foundations, like the Pierce Family Foundation I just mentioned, or the Crown Family Foundation, both here in Chicago, with living founders or living family members who share their wealth for society's benefit. The third type would be community foundations. So those are public charities that make grants to nonprofits in a particular geographic area. So the Tulsa Community Foundation is actually, I think, still the largest in the country. There's a Chicago Community Trust, another community foundation. And then we also have several corporate foundations that are the giving arm of a major corporation, like Chase, for example.
And how about the technology? Does TAG evaluate technology and then promote it to your members to affect that social change? Or is it a little bit of your members working with technology and that brings it to your attention and then you share it throughout the organization? What does it look like to help these organizations leverage technology?
Well, that's a dangerous question. TAG is agnostic about tools and technology. We're an educational organization. So our focus is to connect people to each other and to facilitate knowledge exchange. And in certain cases, we will fund research, but then we'll evaluate, in that case, a whole range of tools available on the market and make that information available for members in the sector as a whole to inform their decision-making process. But what we do more commonly is to promote technology standards or best practices. Mm-hmm. Like best practices, like what's the best rollout methodology or change management methodology for moving your team from local file sharing to cloud-based services like Box or Dropbox? How do you go about doing that? So our members will talk about topics like this. We may put together white papers on how to best manage that change for your organization. Or we sometimes work with other organizations to create and adopt standards. There's a good one. It's called G4G. It's a GuideStar for grant applications. It's a data standard that allows nonprofits to upload information once to its GuideStar profile for that nonprofit. And then every time they apply to a funder who uses a tool that uses that standard, it automatically feeds in their profile information. So that's a time saver, and TAG does play a role in creating these standards and driving adoption in order to save effort, money for our grantees.
And in terms of that process of sharing that information, is it something that you have people on your own staff who are kind of in the field working directly with the people who are utilizing this technology? Or is it something where the opposite, where people from the nonprofits or from the foundations are, you know, feeding you what's happening with them, and from there you take the direction of communicating the standards?
It's both, Emily. It's a both and. We have a board of directors that's very well engaged, that comes from all of the major funders in the country, as well as community funders. We have a strong volunteer base, and then we have staff consultants at TAG. We're a very small group, but we have a few staff consultants. And together, that ecosystem works to assess need. How can philanthropy tech improve itself, right? How can we become more efficient and more effective? So that ecosystem works to A, assess the need, then B, identify where we can work together to better streamline a particular need area. And so by work together, typically that means a couple of key foundations deciding to form a working group, and TAG may facilitate that working group on behalf of those foundations.
Interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about what your volunteers do?
Sure. So we have a number of working groups that our volunteers are part of. So our volunteers come from our members. So our member organizations, I should say. So our volunteers can be working on, for example, we just wrapped up our 2018 State of Philanthropy Tech Survey. We had about 200 foundations nationwide, actually North America, respond to that survey of best practices in philanthropy tech. What's the current state of the practice? Mm-hmm. So I have a working group that helped formulate this survey, and we're currently in the process of analyzing findings, and then we'll begin to craft how we can share that out with the sector as a whole. Another working group might be our Emerging Leaders Initiative, which is a program of TAG to pair emerging leaders with a mentor of more seniority in the sector, and to provide coaching opportunities and educational opportunities for them so that we can better develop a pipeline of future leaders in philanthropy tech.
You mentioned your survey. Will those results be limited to your member organizations, or would that be something that information is made public?
Emily, you are welcome to read the results once I publish them. That's a change this year. We decided to publish out these results publicly in the sector for the basic purpose that if our mission is to help improve technology to serve the mission in philanthropy, we should share those results widely. So I'm a new executive director at TAG this year. I'm about 8 months into my tenure. And this was one of the changes that the committee made, and I was extremely supportive of, and the board was supportive of, to do a better job of sharing out what we learned to the sector as a whole so that we can together become more effective and more efficient.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, something like that is, you know, just one way to increase awareness of this, increase awareness that this is an area where people who work in IT or build software, build, you know, web apps can potentially do, like you said, do something good in their local communities. And so the more information that's out there to the broadest number of people, the better chance you have of really increasing awareness and hopefully having more people involved in this effort.
And I think that also reminds me of the point that Fabian Elliott mentioned in our last talk about how you can't measure success without data. If you don't have foundational information of what's even the baseline to start off with. So these types of information, you know, can be really useful, not just to like, hey, here's where I can help. People can also see where gaps are as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was a great podcast. I love Fabian's work, and I love his approach to being data driven in service of the ultimate outcome that his organization seeks.
I'm curious, what do the demographics of philanthropy tech look like? I have to admit, I have probably a very dated view. Again, it's probably a misconception about philanthropy, but I think of like old white men.
Well, that was the face of technology leadership nationwide in every sector. We're in the midst, like private sector technology organizations, we're in the midst of assessing this right now. The survey that I just mentioned, there were several questions in that survey to understand and benchmark. Where are we right now in philanthropy tech? To be honest, I don't know. I know that many of our member organizations have put a focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion. What I don't know is how well that DEI focus, as it's called, is translating into the IT departments or the grants management departments in those organizations. So that survey that we just closed will help us assess the current state and drive priorities for how TAG and our member organizations can focus on inclusive IT. But I can tell you that overall in the social sector, there's a lot of focus right now on how technology can inadvertently disenfranchise people. Mm-hmm. Have you been hearing the news regarding facial recognition and machine learning techniques?
Yes, we even had an episode on machine learning and AI.
So then I don't need to belabor it, but you know the former college student Joy Bulamwini from MIT found that a facial analysis system couldn't detect her dark-skinned face until she put on a white mask. So this, and she went on to found the Algorithmic Justice League to actually confront bias in algorithms. And I don't know if you maybe shared this on your podcast, but IBM just announced in June two new public data sets for anyone who's training facial recognition systems so that they can overcome bias. Might be fun to promote for your listeners, but these two new data sets are available to anyone so that their facial recognition systems can overcome their programmatic bias.
Oh, I love that. We'll be sure to include that in the show notes. Yeah, you know, those are the kind of challenges that you hear about, and they're so frustrating because it makes me wonder who was on the team that built it in the first place. Because if, you know, we've talked about this a number of times, but if the people building the tech or envisioning the tech are not representative of the people who will use the tech, it's missing something. It's missing that even just test of does this work or is this offensive? You need someone right. On the team to offer a perspective like that.
This is personally to me, so not speaking on behalf of my organization, but speaking personally, this is extremely important to me because time and time again, you'll look at a development team for a particular product or tool, and it's a very homogenous group. And yet that tool is designed to serve a very diverse audience. And so when you launch a product or a tool like that and you don't see the adoption that you were looking for, I think it's important to pause and say, if perhaps we had people from that community or who are similar to that community on the team helping us design this, we might actually have designed it for their needs. And this is basic human-centered design and design thinking, but the reality is it's much harder to do that when your team looks nothing like your target audience.
And I think I also want to point out that technology isn't just limited to our phones or the internet even, or the computer screens. Technology could be anything that is a machine that you're interacting with that's analyzing you for whatever reason. Because when you mentioned the facial recognition situation, there was this meme that was going around on Twitter where it was the soap dispenser. Have you heard this story?
I haven't.
So it's the same concept. Basically, the soap dispenser lasers analyze light. And so when this gentleman, who happened to be black, put his hand underneath the soap dispenser, it would not dispense any soap.
Ugh.
Yeah. And then put a napkin on his hand.
Ugh. Oh,
right,
no.
Right. And then so that was like a GIF that was going, you know, forward to just kind of explain how bias and assumptions and improper testing and not enough testing leads to these issues. And to be frank, I'm not really the darkest skin Filipino, but ever since I've seen that and I've had difficulty getting an automatic sink to start or any automatic thing to start, I wonder, it's like, is my skin actually too dark for a split second that it doesn't have the right enough tint? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a weird thing to think about.
Imagine a lifetime of those microaggressions feeling like you're somehow not quite right. So this is why I'm so thrilled about the Ford Foundation's public interest tech movement, which I mentioned earlier. The focus on bringing some of the best minds in technology to bring their approach, their talent to answering some of these questions and to crafting tools and systems to support public good in the most equitable way possible. I'm thrilled about that focus for them. We need more of those kinds of folks, even addressing basic issues like an equitable soap dispenser. But scale that all the way up to facial recognition systems that are used by a police force. We need the greatest minds in technology to be helping us think about these questions in more inclusive and equitable ways.
What do you find then are the biggest challenges to implement, you know, philanthropy tech? Like, what's stopping people from moving forward?
I would say that my members on the operational side of the house, they're doing a great job in keeping the laptops on and the networks up. There are some challenges on the operation side of the house that are new in the past several years, but security is a really big issue. Mm-hmm. For folks, as you can imagine, the need to keep systems secure, to secure private information that grantees may be submitting. Even things like when their staff travel to high-risk countries where hardware can be compromised, how do you set up a quarantine approach so that all equipment incoming and outgoing is quarantined so you're not bringing in compromising programs into your network? So that's a new space. And in fact, there's a desire for funders to work on security issues with their grantees and including in a grant funding to address security issues for those grantees themselves. We're seeing a lot of ransomware attacks on philanthropy. As you can imagine, there's a lot of money there. So strengthening cybersecurity for the social sector as a whole is a prime concern right now.
That makes sense. That's a big concern for everyone right now. I mean, our government.
Census 2020 is a very hot topic, for example, right now. And security around that census, and several of my funders are thinking about security and data privacy around Census 2020. What I would say in terms of philanthropy tech as a challenge, one thing that we're seeing is how do we work across funders? Let's step back and imagine New Orleans. There is not one single funder working in New Orleans right now. You might have 15, 20, 50 foundations funding work in New Orleans. Well, how do those foundations work together in order to understand where's there the greatest need? Where should we collaborate? Thirdly, how do we understand if what we're doing is working? Mm-hmm. Or are we just throwing away money and not reaching the people with the greatest need with the most effective intervention? That ability to share data and integrate systems across funders, that's a big challenge right now in philanthropy. And TAG is working on this. Several of our member leaders are working on this. But that's an ongoing challenge, is that to work at scale across funders to understand how to improve society.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that like the ideal scenario to have the greatest impact, to have these systems and foundations working together? I imagine that's probably going to be an absolute game changer once it, you know, becomes something that's very clear and reliable.
I would hope so. Several of my members would hope so. At the same time, we're also being very cautious and respectful of the privacy issues inherent in that work. You know, making sure that relationships with grantees are not compromised in any way, that the privacy of their information is maintained. There are innumerable issues there that we're being very cautious about, because the desire is to maintain respectful, authentic relationships at the same time as trying to understand need and outcomes at scale.
So complex.
It is, but it's for the greater good. And so these are solvable problems. We can get there.
So speaking of solvable problems, what resources like books, events, workshops do you recommend for our listeners who want to learn more about philanthropy tech?
I'd love to share a few ideas here. So I mentioned public interest tech. I'd get out on Twitter, follow hashtag public interest tech by the Ford Foundation, come up to speed there, stay engaged, help promote that movement. I'd also suggest maybe following thinkers like Beth Cantor. Mm-hmm. She's one of the leading thinkers in nonprofit tech. You guys know her?
I don't know her personally, but I do follow her on Twitter.
Yeah, she's great to follow, right? She's really has her finger on the pulse of nonprofit technology. I would also say if you are a nonprofit or a tech practitioner or consultant serving nonprofits, follow N10, the Nonprofit Technology Network. Amy Sample Ward, a colleague and a friend, is just great. I love the work they're doing. Their conference is so much fun, reinvigorating, and a great learning experience every year in spring. And then if you are a funder or you'd like to break into philanthropy tech, maybe you're a CIO in the private sector and you're looking to think about how your career can have more impact and you're looking to break into the philanthropy tech space, consider joining my organization's annual conference. Come on down to Tucson, November 5th through the 8th. And the website for our conference is tag2018.org. It's a 300-person conference. It's designed for intimate networking and learning. So it's a great place to get started on what's going on in philanthropy tech and begin to network into that space.
Oh, exciting. And so that's still available for ticket sales?
We just opened a couple of weeks ago, so yes.
Any final advice for our listeners who would like to actually apply their knowledge, their skills to support social good in their communities?
My message would be that your skills are more valuable now than ever before. If you're someone who can bridge both worlds, technology and social justice or social impact, if you can bridge both of those worlds, consider applying your skills for the betterment of our society, of our world. And that sounds trite, but there are so many ways you can get involved. Perhaps as a volunteer at a civic hackathon, for example. I would urge you to network in and join a nonprofit board. I can't tell you how hard it is to find people with technology skills to join a board of directors. In my case, that's not hard because all my members are technology leaders. But most nonprofits, the other boards that I'm on, it's very difficult to find folks with tech skills, and it's really critical. Mm-hmm. And then I would say consider even a 2 to 3 year career sabbatical in which you maybe take a career shift in the social sector, either working for a philanthropy for a few years. Get that social sector experience. Go back to private sector if you'd like, but consider doing some crossover move in your career.
You know, Chantal, I just want to follow up on that last point because I've known you for a long time, and I feel like that's something you did where you were working a lot with, not corporations, but I know you were working with the labs and the school. But, you know, then when you moved to Chicago, you got really involved with, I believe it was the Kellogg Foundation. Was that an intentional shift along those same lines?
You know, I'd love to say I was strategic. I've been strategic through my whole career. But the truth is I started with an IBM company doing data mining, predictive analytics, writing for a predictive analytics product, and then moved into the public sector, and then started through client work being exposed to the social sector. And what I will say is I love working at scale. And so when you're working on data mining tools, you're thinking at scale. And then when you're working for a government, when I ran digital for the city of Albuquerque, you're thinking about a million people coming to your website to use a bill pay app. The ability to work in philanthropy and think about that $60 billion of investment in social change in this country, and to think about how can I help, how can my colleagues help improve the outcomes of that investment? It's really hard to walk away from that kind of career shift when you think about how you spend your time every day. So I can't say that it's been strategic, but it's been incredibly rewarding.
And, you know, just to say a little something to our listeners, like, I think what Chantal is describing is a really impactful way to, you know, take your career. But you can even go on a smaller scale. I mean, you know, Leigh and I are highly focused on keeping our business running. It's a full-time job, but we really do try to, for example, use this podcast as a medium to introduce our listeners to ideas that maybe aren't common conversations when you go to conferences or meetups or whatever, and that are focused on these social issues. And that's just a really small way we're trying to contribute and use our tech skills and knowledge to kind of, you know, affect social change. So it can be big, it can be small, but I do feel like you should do something. It feels good and it helps. It helps beyond yourself.
And thank you. Thank you for making that investment, Leah and Emily. I think you're the poster children for making the time to use your skills for the greater good. So thank you.
Appreciate that. Well, this was such a thoughtful episode, lots to chew on, but that's all the time we have for today. But before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready, Chantal?
I'm ready. I have no idea what these questions are, but I'm ready.
Okay. First question. What's your go-to karaoke song?
Eyes Without a Face.
Oh, good one. What advice would you give your younger self?
I would tell myself, embrace risk earlier. It took me into my 30s before I became really comfortable with risk. I wish I'd started that in my 20s.
What's your favorite PG-rated curse word?
Oh, that's a good one. I have my fiance has a 10-year-old daughter, so we try to become experts in curse words. You know, I'd say being from the Midwest, the freaking is probably overused.
All right, who's your favorite superhero?
Oh, my favorite superhero. You know, I would say that I don't have one, but I would say that when I met my fiance online, he asked me if I had any superhero skills, and I didn't have an answer, but I said, well, I'm a beekeeper. Does that count?
What's your favorite time of the year?
I love fall. September in Chicago will sucker you in. Don't come to Chicago in September because you'll think the whole year is like that, and then you'll move here, and there's really only one month like that.
If you could change one thing about the web, what would it be?
That's a great question. And I would go back to what Leah talked about earlier. I would, if I could wave a magic wand, I'd make the founders of the internet and I'd make the early teams working on the web, I'd make them much more diverse so that it wasn't set up for one particular demographic from the onset, that it was co-created by a much more diverse population and therefore much more equitable and available for a much more diverse segment of our country.
What are three words that describe you?
Words that describe me. Oh, interesting. I would say tenacious. I would say joyful. And I would hope that I usually aim to be thoughtful.
How about three words that describe your work?
You know, I love what I do. So to describe the work that I'm doing right now for TAG, I would say it is highly collaborative. It's very aspirational and idealistic. I would also hope that it's impactful.
What's your favorite meal of the day?
Favorite meal of the day, anything with mac and cheese. That could be for breakfast, but whatever it is, if there's mac and cheese, I'm in.
All right, last question. Coffee or tea?
Tea.
Perfect. So that's all the time we have today. Thanks for joining the show.
It's been so wonderful to be with you both. Thank you so much.
In case our listeners wanted to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
I'm on Twitter under Coco Forster. You can always email me, Chantal@tagtech.org, or look me up on LinkedIn, Chantal Forster.
Great. We'll make sure to have a link to that in our show notes. Thanks again, Chantal. It was great having you on the show to talk about this.
Such a pleasure. Thank you again.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency invested in education and social good. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor.
Many thanks to our hosting partner, ArcusTech, who wanted a shout out at the top of the episode.
And many thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter @ControlClickCast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, consider donating to the show. Then give us a review on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or both. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll talk with Jeremy Keith about offline web experiences. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis.
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.